specific analysis.
Sorry, I forgot about this. Sorry. Yeah.
So this tolerance puzzle is bigger than this any analysis. And so again, what you will see, of course, I will talk mostly about two analyses, but the questions that I wish to discuss today and kind of bring you to your attention is bigger than, well, any specific algorithm for finding the PDFs. Well, there is a set of questions that we don't normally discuss within the particle physics community. However, they are quite familiar to experts that work on large scale analysis in other areas. In particular, I will bring a lot of reference to voting service. And so, in fact, some of the problems that we discuss in physics, well, they can be cast in mathematically in a way that has similarity to voting service. Wow. And so the issues that you see we have with voting service actually will also arise in our cases, and you will see how. And so then there is the so-called big data paradox that was put a force a couple of years ago to explain why voting service underperformed. So they make very confident statements that turn out to be wrong. So now, and then a part of it is related to psychology, but actually a large part of it is related to mathematics of multidimensional distributions. And so that's what I would like to emphasize, that basically there are these mathematical issues that affect any kind of large-scale data analysis. Now, the good thing about us is that we can introduce techniques to more reliably sample relevant combinations of PDFs. And so the technique that I will propose to you, and that each of you in principle can use to kind of validate the nominal uncertainties that we get from the groups, well, it's called the Hoskosh scan technique. And so I'll try to explain it. It is basic. It's okay. So you will see it's not that complicated, but there are some technical aspects that you need to understand. Okay, so now please also ask me questions. So one other question that I really would like to emphasize is that the PDF uncertainties right now are constrained by our models of correlated systematic errors that come from the experiments. And again, there is this whole set of issues that perhaps the theorists and experimentalists can discuss together. How we better represent correlated systematic errors in the from the analysis. Okay. Now, very briefly, I will kind of remind you why we talk about quantum distribution functions and show you a few slides several energy frontier groups prepared to emphasize the role of QCD for the snow mass study in Seattle. And essentially, well, this slides pointed out that QCD remains a very interesting part of particle physics. Well, for several reasons, right? So it's the only QFT that can be experimentally studied with high accuracy, both in perturbative and non-perturbative phases. It is also a key theory in many predictions that we do for new physics searches or for studies on the Higgs sector. And finally, there is if you look at the snow mass contributions, this area has lots of interesting new ideas and very interesting efforts that basically tell us that QCD is a very lively field, right? Now, if we think about QCD calculations for the LHC or the Tevatron, so many of them will require quantum distribution functions. And so quantum distribution functions can come in several varieties. So I will talk about the usual collinear PDFs that depend on momentum fraction X and the resolution scale Q. Now, some of the issues that I will discuss will be relevant for any kind of non-perturbative function, whether TMD or GPD, whatever. All right. So basically, any kind of analysis of non-perturbative functions will have similar issues that I will point out. And then, of course, you know that this quantum distribution functions are used in many places. Like, for example, here I showed you the cross section for Higgs production that contains the hard cross section that we can calculate perturbatively. Plus, it's multiplied by two non-perturbative quantum distribution functions that I will discuss. There are some power suppressed terms that always appear in the full factorization formula, but that we don't include in our analysis. I will not talk so much about them, except at the very end, perhaps I will briefly mention. Well, they can be important in some cases. Basically, we have these kind of formulas for many processes, right? And so then, for example, the Higgs physics will have about 20 times more data than the current data within the next few years. And Okay, so I'll skip this. Animations quickly, but basically, for Higgs cross section, we can calculate the hard contribution up to N3 law in QCD. But then there is a large part of the uncertainty comes from the uncertainty on alpha S and PDFs. And so if you look how the uncertainty on PDFs and alpha S scales with the energy or with the order of the calculation, it's not necessarily obvious that you can suppress the uncertainty due to the PDFs as efficiently as the scale dependence of the hard cross section. So, so Higgs physics is one example of what we do. The other prominent example is WMS measurement. And so there was a discussion by George Isaacson pointing out at this low mass, pointing out that QCD plus electroweak theory should dominate the theory uncertainties on WMS measurement. And PDFs also contribute to a large part of this uncertainty. There are many other processes that are used by experimentalists. And so here is a Lizush wish list showing requested accuracy for theoretical calculations for various measurements, mostly at the LHC, I believe. Right? And so they need accurate QCD predictions, which means that we need to calculate the hard cross sections to the accuracy that is requested here. So we have lots of progress going on loop calculations. And so here is a slide from Fabio Maltoni showing how quickly we can include new topologies and high orders in the calculation. And really, basically, there is this dramatic progress in the calculations, which the calculations at upper that corner has been done already. The calculations in the lower right corner in red are not available yet. But because of the automated tools that we have for the calculations in perturbative contributions, well, this frontier between green and red moves down quite quickly, right? And so therefore, we clearly will have lots of very, very beautiful perturbative calculations that we can use. But if you want to reach the needed accuracy in the calculation, we have to know PDFs to a comparable level. And so what comparable level is that kind of varies by the process, but let's say within a decade, ideally, we want to have PDFs that are known with accuracy 1, maybe 2%. Not larger than that. And now getting that accuracy on the PDFs, so that's basically a major challenge. And so I will discuss one aspect of this big puzzle, but something else that I want to point out to you is that the PDFs is not just a theoretical analysis. So basically, there is also crosstalk between three domains in the global PDF hits. So we have to think about experimental aspects of the data sets that go in. And so this means both the fixed target data and the collider data. We have to think about theoretical contributions. Well, basically, how we calculate our cross sections, how to reliably and quickly estimate high order corrections in the theoretical cross section gets more and more complicated with each order of alpha S. And then there is a big part of statistics. And so today what I will talk about is the statistics part, right? So like even if you have the precise data, you have precise theory. There can be additional aspects in this, well, statistics of this big data analysis. And so here is an example of the experimental data that goes into CT18 analysis. So if you analyze this kind of data, there can be additional issues that are not controlled simply by accuracy of experimental theory, but also by the inference, by the statistical analysis process. Okay. Yes.
I had a question on the previous slide, the one about the multiple scales. Maybe this is naive, but when you say, you know, the more number of scales, what are some like examples of the difficulties that arise because you have, say, multiple scales, like when you have these like multiple loops.
Okay, this is exactly the same here. Yeah. No, here we just count the number of loops. So each loop will give you, well, basically, it's the integral gets complex, but basically there is a sort of exponential growth of the complexity of the relevant matrix elements.
Right. But yeah. I mean, in terms of like the unphysical scale that you have to plug into. To evaluate like the factorization scale,
So the scale uncertainty should go down as we increase the number of loops if the perturbation theory converge. Yeah. So basically, okay. So there is this separate question about which scales you use, right?
Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. So the PDFs will usually depend on the normalization scale and factorization scale, and there is a certain art in selecting these two scales. So the one of the reasons we try to include more and more loops is because we reduce the scale dependence successively, right? Mm-hmm. Is the and sometimes you will find that you know, if you calculate it at the low enough order, so the scale for some reason you need to use a strange very small or very large scale to describe the data.
I mean, I guess because usually I see we have two scales that we vary now, right? You know, the factorization, right?
Uh-huh.
You say more number of loops, the more number of scales.
No. The loops do not introduce additional scales.
Okay.
So the
sorry,
scales are determined by the observable.
There's a different scale. Then
yeah.
There's the problem, right? If like if you're calculating Higgs at pi loops, then you have the scale of the top mass isn't the problem, right? That's a different scale than like a real loop.
Right.
Yeah. But that's just whether or not you do the top mass assumption, right?
But it's essentially a third scale that I guess you have.
I guess that was where I'm going. It's like there's this third scale that is like, what is the mass of the on-shell particle in the loop, right? That's like another scale, right?
Yeah, but your scales are really determined by that your kinematics of your observable.
Okay.
And so many of this additional, basically, momentum in these loops are integrated out. But what is left in the end is some kind of dependence on a typical. Physical scale plus this normalization and factorization scale, and then you need to set up this normalization and factorization scales properly so that they do not have large logs of Q squared over mu squared in this particular contributions.
And is that mostly orthogonal to concerns about the PDF?
And so this will be orthogonal to what I will discuss.
Okay.
However, there is a connection in which is the following. So why do we do this higher and higher calculations? What this means is that if we choose a specific scale, well, for example, specific choice of scales, specific PDF set, your calculation gets more and more accurate. So the individual calculation, right? So therefore you would say, okay, so I kind of get more and more precise prediction for my observable. But there is an additional aspect that the PDF parameterizations are not set in cast in stone. And so then when you find the PDF parameterizations, you also do some sampling over all possible data sets or all possible analysis. And that's separate from the accuracy of individual predictions. And so that's what I will emphasize. Basically, when you think about the total accuracy, normally we talk about the accuracy of individual theoretical prediction for individual scales. There is this whole other aspect about what I would call sampling accuracy, and you will see how it will come in. Okay, and that uncertainty actually can be larger than the accuracy of individual predictions. Okay. So then let me ask you actually, how much do you want me to kind of give a basic introduction about the PDFs? Because I have a few slides kind of remind you how the PDFs work.
I can use that.
That would be,
yeah. Okay. Right. Okay. So now let's look again at the calculation from the viewpoint of the user, right? So suppose you need to make a prediction Higgs cross section, and you use some what you call the Monte Carlo program. But Monte Carlo program, well, it's not just, well, there are many kinds of theoretical calculations. They will all be lumped into this big category of the Monte Carlo generators. But fundamentally, in a typical Monte Carlo program, you will do a calculation like this, right? So so now you ask, what is the uncertainty on the left hand side? Well, one kind of an uncertainty comes from the contribution sigma hat, right? But also the pattern distribution functions are also known with the sum uncertainty. So then the full uncertainty will be, the quadrature sum of all possible uncertainties, right? So now we will talk about the uncertainties on this part. So where this uncertainty comes from. And first of all, how do we evaluate this uncertainty? So what we do is that like a group like CTAC T group, will give you a set of pattern distribution functions. And so this is a set of what CT18 that we released in 2019, which shows basically that for each pattern flavor, you have a pattern distribution function as a function of the momentum fraction X. Now, these PDFs are not calculated from lattice QCD, so they are found by fitting the data, right? And so the data comes from DIS, fixed target Relian production processes, LHC data, and somehow there is a set of PDFs that well describes all this measurements relatively well. we do this calculation to the next to next to leading order of alpha s so that we reduce some additional uncertainties. Well, there is a big issue about the functional form for the PDFs, and that's actually what kind of is tied to what I will discuss. The PDF functional form is not unique. And so you need to decide what is the right functional form. And that actually gives you a large part of the uncertainty here. So that, well, like if you take our analysis, about half of the total uncertainty on the PDFs comes from the choice of the functional form that we try. Okay, so that's a big issue. So therefore the PDFs are given in terms of the set of PDF, and then there are error PDF sets that you can estimate the uncertainty on the PDFs that is shown here as a green band or black band. So you also need to assign the confidence level to what you show, right? So therefore, well, estimating the uncertainties is quite hard, but also you have other choices. For example, within this paper, we provide four sets. We use the default CT18 that we can use in most cases. But then there are some measurements, like for example, the Atlas ZW cross-section measurement. That is not agreeing very well with the HERA data. And so if we include that data set, we get a very different PDF. And so then we also can change the scale in the GAS data so that our gluon changes the shape at small x. And so then we get the PDF set for CT18Z, which has more or less the same chi-square, but actually it has somewhat different behavior of the PDFs. And so you will see some comparisons between CT18 and CT18Z. And so what's more important is that within our group, we don't know which set is the best, because one of them includes more data, but the data are not very consistent. So what again this means is that if you take the data out, your PDF changes. So therefore, basically sampling over the experiments introduces, well, a large part of this difference between CT18 and CT18Z. Okay, all right, yes.
Naive question, why is the uncertainty on strange so much larger than say charm? I would have
thought because the measurements are not very precise. And so for example, this Zeta and W measurement data at the LHC is sensitive to strange. Now, charm here is generated purely perturbatively from the gluon, which is constrained very well.
Yeah.
If you have so-called intrinsic charm, so then this band blows up for the charm. Okay, so that's another question. Again, if I have time, I can get to it. But that's what we discussed on Tuesday about this charm idea. Okay. Now, the other thing is that again, you will learn when you start calculating this PDF uncertainties is that there are two varieties of error PDFs. So basically to calculate these error bands, you need to have so-called error PDFs, but the error PDFs comes in two types. So one of them are so-called Hessian PDFs, which are obtained from analytic minimization of chi-squared. And so most of the groups provide you so-called Hessian PDFs, and then you calculate the uncertainty using so-called master formula for the Hessian PDFs. And then there is another set called based on Monte Carlo set replicas. And so-called neural network PDF approach is the one that uses this technology. So basically for neural network PDF, you parameterize the PDF using a neural network. So it's kind of like a flexible functional form. And then you randomly sample your solutions. Basically what you do is that you do resampling, you vary, fluctuate the data. And so you feed the fluctuated data, you get one of the green solutions, and then the total error band is simply the unweighted average over these solutions. Okay, so then you ask, well, which set is better? The answer is it depends, right? So because each of them has pros and cons, and furthermore, Hessian PDFs, what we believe is that actually they continue to carry lots of important information. They may be easier to use in some cases. They also get closer to the global minimum as you see. Monte Carlo PDFs, well, they are more flexible in a sense, right? And furthermore, you can convert Hessian PDFs into the Monte Carlo ones, and similarly, you can convert Monte Carlo PDFs into the Hessian ones. Okay, so then there is kind of a crosstalk between these two representations. And then there are several groups that provide their events using this various techniques, like for example, in addition to CT18, and the NPDF, so there is a very nice set called MSHT20, which was released recently, using more or less the same main data sets as the other groups. There is ABMP16, which is an older set. It gives you quite a different error band. And there is also the Atlas PDF21 set. Now, that one includes the recent Atlas data and the HERA data. So it's a combined Kernel data, and that kind of provides the most important constrained analysis. Okay, and so then you can look at the error sets from this group. So you see the error bands, well, they come each with the uncertainty. Sometimes uncertainties overlap, sometimes they don't overlap. And so you ask why they don't overlap. And the size of the uncertainty also changes. Okay, so for example, if you look at the plot of the PDF uncertainties from these five sets, well, here is a comparison of uncertainties. Well, the uncertainty can vary by a factor of two also, right? So basically, there is a variation in uncertainty. You ask why the uncertainties are different. Similarly, partner luminosities will show the same trend. So partner luminosities, will have quite different shapes. And if you would wish to measure the Grill cross-section with high accuracy, you somehow need to do something about the fact that the error bands from the groups, they don't quite overlap. So somehow you will have to average over these different PDF sets if you really want to get an uncertainty on the Higgs cross-section. And now here is another plot that I will actually discuss quite a bit. Let's just look at the two sigma error ellipses for specific benchmark cross-sections from the LHC. Okay, and so the differences in the PDFs that you saw in the previous slides, they translate into regions which are predicted to be most likely according to different PDF sets. And so that's what I will discuss today, is that what you conclude just by looking at this ellipses, they are amazing. You see the sizes of these ellipses are quite different, right? And so this, now I told you that CTM, SHT and NPDF, they fit more or less the same data. But for example, so the CT18 error bands or ellipses shown by red, so they are substantially larger than the NPDF 4.0 error bands, right? So these are nominal uncertainties. So that's what I will call nominal uncertainties, okay? And so that's what I would like to discuss. So why their ellipses are so different, okay? So now this actually has implications for various things that we do. So because we increasingly rely on the estimation of PDF uncertainties in very complex contexts. Right, so for example, one context where PDFs are important are so-called SMF PDF combined feeds. And so what you find is that your limits on high dimensional operators arising from potential big base M physics, they actually can be modified quite a bit by PDF uncertainties. And roughly speaking, if you fit these operators together with PDFs, you can get a different estimate on the the allowed range of parameters than when you fit SMEFs PDFs only. Okay. Yes.
How did those get introduced? Is it like in the deep lab that you introduce the SMEF coefficients, or how?
Yeah. So basically, you extend your Lagrangian by terms like four Fermi interaction, except there is a general framework for that.
Yeah.
And then there are additional coefficients in the standard effective extension of the standard model that you can fit together with partner distributions, alpha S, etc. Okay.
I mean, in like the fit to extract the PDF, you're saying, or are you saying that, is this comparing the uncertainties from the PDF to the?
So the point is the following: you could take one of these 10 PDFs with the uncertainties, and then you simply propagate your uncertainty from the 10 PDF set into your analysis fit of the SMEF coefficients. Or you can include SMELT coefficients into your analysis of PDFs and look for correlations. And so that may change your
exclusion limits. How do you do the latter technically?
There is a technique, but again, it will rely on some sort of Monte Carlo sampling. That's a very common approach. And to look at this paper, it's a quite complete paper describing how to do that, right? So, but basically, the important thing is that this kind of more complex analysis cannot rely just on analytic minimization because it's very slow, but people rely on Monte Carlo sampling techniques. Okay, so to get this analysis, and it's more complicated fit than the PDFs themselves. Now there is another thing that kind of major development that many codes for fitting the PDFs become available publicly. Whoever works on the standard model, actually, that you may have refit your PDF using the CMS data, the W plus charm production or something like this. And so this is done using the, several publicly available codes. One of them is called XFitter. So now NPDF released their own public code. And that's a very powerful, very fast code. So it's very interesting to run it. And then there are other codes. For example, there is a Hessian updating code, which is released by the Michigan State Group. Now, these programs are very powerful, and it's also easy to get good results. It's also easy to misuse them. And so the one issue that you, okay, it actually happened a number of times. When people use these programs, they are what is called the tolerance on the PDFs that they assume is not consistent with the PDF set that they reread. And so that made a produce, well, okay, so the tolerance is basically the confidence level that you assign to these error bands. So that's what the tolerance is. And if you do not assign it properly, so you can get misleading unrealistic uncertainties from your analysis. And so that's what happens even with the CMS results that have been published a few years ago. Okay, so therefore, well, use it with caution. But yet another aspect of this is that now we're quite comfortable with all these fancy methods for the PDFs. And so there is a so-called PDF for C21 combination. So if you are not care too much about PDF uncertainties, you could combine several PDF sets into, well, kind of an average PDF set called PDF for C21. And then you do your calculation with that set. And so when you combine the PDF sets, well, you ask what exactly you are combining. Are you combining apples with apples or apples with tangerines or whatever? So basically, there is this question about the meaning of the uncertainties. Okay. So now this question is actually very deep, and it is not connected just to particle physics. And that's what I would like to discuss in the second half of the talk. Basically, it can be formulated as a sort of a puzzle that I already pointed out to you. Is that let's assume, well, we know now that if we fit similar data sets, for example, using CTI method and NPDF method, we can get quite different uncertainty estimates. So CT will be in red, and latest NPDF 4.0 will be in blue. Okay, so they come out to be different. And so we know that actually it's not because we use different data sets, even if we use more or less the same data set. In fact, it's a part of this PDF 4C21 combination. We took pretty much the same, what is called reduced data set, and we fitted it using separately CTI, MSHT, and NNPDF codes and methodology. The uncertainties that we get out of this analysis, they agree more or less between MSHT and CT. CT always is a little bit on the higher side, but NNPDF 3.1 gives you about a factor of 2 less uncertainty. And this goes even lower with 4.0. So basically, when we fit the same data set, we get different uncertainty estimates. Okay. Now let me pause here. So then the question is basically, well, what's going on? So does anyone underestimate or overestimate the uncertainty? And that's what I would like to discuss now. Okay. So then we looked at various things and various aspects, and I think our answer is the following. So that these large differences in uncertainty estimates can be due to the density of sampling of possible PDF solutions. So basically what happens in all these big studies is that our models of, let's say 30 plus experiments are huge. They depend on hundreds of parameters. And when we have such big models, so we run into a major issue with efficiency of sampling. So that's what actually you see in the voting service that I mentioned to you. So if you think very carefully, well, there is a kind of similarity between these plots that I'm showing and the responses for voting service. Like now, what will voting service do? Basically, somebody like, I don't know, a polling company calls respondents and asks, will you vote for Republicans or Democrats? And so they get an answer. So here we could imagine the same. We do not dial the humans, but we ask each PDF feed, what cross-section value do you get? Okay, so then we populate the display, and then we say, okay, 68% of, or 90% of the CT18 PDFs predict the cross section over here. And the NPDF predicts at this very narrow place here. Okay, now what is also very clear from this analysis of the past few elections is that the service the voting polls greatly underperform. And they underperform not because people are lying, but because of the efficiency of sampling of these multi-dimensional distributions. So then there is a so-called big data paradox that was put forth by a statistician from Harvard, Sarah Li Meng. And you can read a short summary of what it is. What he pointed out is that now these differences are not, again, so they are related to the fact that we're sampling a very large multidimensional space with very complex geometry. And when we do that, it's very easy to introduce a bias in sampling. Okay, now bias may work in your favor. For example, when you write, we can also think about this as like a quasi Monte Carlo integration program. So quasi Monte Carlo integration problems. You are sampling answers over some phase space. Well, if you sample them smartly, you can actually get the right result much faster than if you sample it randomly. But the opposite is also true. If you are not smart at sampling it, so you can be very quickly misled into some wrong result. But your Monte Carlo will return a very small nominal error. So you can get the wrong result, but with a high confidence because your nominal error is small, okay? So something like this may happen here, okay? And so in fact, well, there is a large volume of literature which is discussing it. And the gist of this is falling. So now you can ask, well, what's the right confidence prescription that we can apply to the PDFs? So the bad news is that this answer cannot be, this answer is intractable. This problem is intractable in general. So in general, you cannot assign the perfect tolerance prescription that will work in all cases. And the main reason is that if you really want to assign it properly, you have to sample the parameter space with high accuracy in many dimensions. And for that, you have to have a huge number of replicas, so that grows exponentially with the number of parameters. So therefore, this the tolerance puzzle, if you ask me, well, which tolerance of the out of these three sets is correct one? So I cannot answer it in general. And so again, there is kind of theorems that tell you that, you cannot say in general which uncertainty band is better. But the good news is that now, the main reason you have this constraint is because you try to study probability distributions in 100, 300 dimensions. And now, typical QCD observables do not depend on 300 parameters, PDF parameters. They depend maybe on 4, 5, 6, 7 combination of parameters. And so therefore, if you can identify those few components that drive the PDF uncertainty, so you can write your sampling much more efficiently in that direction. And that's what the gist of this hopscotch scan technique that I will describe in a second. Okay, so let me pause here and see if you have any questions, comments.
Yeah. So you mentioned that different groups like work with different functional form, like a big parameter, yeah. But like how the group determine like which functional form we use at the beginning.
Well, that's a part of so it's a part of the decision. And so the answer is that we try as many functional forms as possible. And so there are very efficient ways to construct reasonable functional forms. The neural network is the symbol, kind of the most famous one, right? Because the neural network can approximate any function. Actually, the neural network in general is too flexible. But within CETA group, we actually use another approach based on so-called Bezier curves. And Bezier curves are these flexible curves, let's say, that you draw in PowerPoint. If you need to draw a curve in PowerPoint, it has this kind of very flexible form, and you vary control points, and you can get any function very easily. And so that's what is actually implemented in the CT18 analysis right now. Okay, so but now, what ultimately you do is you should try a large number of parameterization forms, and then your uncertainty somehow should reflect this parameterization dependence. Okay, so that next slide, it kind of explains what's going on.
How do you deal with the bias variance trade-off? Like how many, for example, in the case of the Bezier curves, how many control points to include?
The answer is that, so you try as many as possible.
Theoretically, if you have like infinite number of control points, you can perfectly fit it, right? And then
there are techniques like cross-validation, for example, which tell you that you're not supposed to do that. So then basically there will be always some kind of smoothness or cross-validation condition that tells you that your PDF should not do something like this, right? It should be smooth. But that's a part of the issue is, right? So what the smoothness is, for example, how exactly you impose smoothness. Now, again, if you make a judgment about your physics observation, so you must at least to consider this possibility that there can be dependence on this parameterization form, right? And so that's kind of what what I'm trying to drive here. Okay. Now, in our parameterization, just for your information, well, it's one of the four big classes of uncertainties in this analysis. So now, methodological uncertainty is another one. And so this means basically you can do the fit in multiple ways, you will get slightly different results. And this kind of falls into, together with theoretical and experimental uncertainty. And a part of each of these uncertainty will include some sampling. Like within theoretical calculation, you will do Monte Carlo integration, well, there is a sampling. When you select experiments or select data points, there is also some sampling involved. And so what I pointed out to you is that, of course, we can talk about accuracy of each individual fit, but similarly, there is the sampling accuracy. So how you do the sample, samples are, is important. And that's what actually where what gets us, because the sampling accuracy is the difficult part, right? So now again, let me go back to this paper. Well, what happens is that, it's not that just the whole volume is very large. There is something else is going on. The law of large numbers does not work in the simplest way when you do the sampling, because you can introduce biases when you do this analysis. And so here is an example. Well, again, I can come back to it to explain what's going on. But basically, there are studies showing that, for example, the main issue in the polls is not trustworthiness of individual respondents. It's not the fact that you have a small data sample. It's really the biases that gets you. That's why the polls do not work properly. Okay. And so this plot, if you like, I can explain what's going on. But basically, what this plot shows is that there are this sampling bias that depends not only on the size of your sample, but depends on the size of the whole population. Okay. And so the size of the sampling bias can grow with the size of the population, which cannot be easily compensated by the size of the sample. Okay.
Sorry, when you say that the bias, you're saying the bias in how you decide the components that make up your sample.
Right. Well, let me give you an example. Okay. So what I meant. Okay. So let's suppose I would like to make a prediction for Higgs cross section based on CT18 MSHA and NNPDF calculations. So I could take 300 ERP sets from CT, 300 from MSHT, and 300 from NNPDF. Right, and then I ask what is the average value or mean value based on this 900 replicas, right? So then the simplest thing I will do, I will calculate the mean value. And so then let's say what I did here is, so my mean value, my expectation value, I think is, so it's called mu here. And let's assume, somehow I vary this mu around the truth value. So basically, I know truth value. In this example, I know the truth value we had. And then I vary my error PDFs around this truth value with some random deviation. And so then if I, lowercase n is the number of my replicas. So then naively, I expect the more replicas I have, if I select them randomly from all these three sets. So then the difference between my expectation and the truth goes down as the standard deviation divided by the square root of the number of replicas. Okay, so if I take 10,000 replicas in total instead of 900, I will get my mu closer to the truth, mu bar, and so that's basically what is shown in the histograms here. Okay, now, but it only works if I randomly select replicas from CT, MSHT, and then PDF. For example, if you ask, if I select 300 from CT, 300 from MSHT, and 300 from NNPDF, it's not random, right? So you may ask, do you introduce the bias here? Well, the answer is that because I use the same number of replicas, actually in this case, somehow there is an averaging, I do not pick up the bias. Now, I can clearly introduce the bias. For example, I could take, I take 200 items from NNPDF, and I take 400 items from CT. And CT and NNPDF do not like each other exactly, right? So then I will get the bias in the expectation, right? So then now in this case, I clearly introduced the bias. I know I will pick up the bias. Well, what happens though is that now here we see the bias quite clearly. We kind of put it by hand. But if we do this multi-dimensional sampling, so you can introduce these biases very easily and by various means. And so then there is a very nice formula that tells you that Well, this bias can be written in general in is a product of three terms. One will be called inherent problem difficulty. So it's basically, it's essentially the standard deviation of your population. The other one will be called measure discrepancy. So which tells you, like, if I select a very small sample from a very large population, so I have a measure discrepancy. My measure is different for the sample and the population. And then there is a confounding correlation. And so the confounding correlation is basically telling you how efficient your sampling algorithm is. And it's literally correlation. It takes values between minus one and one. Okay. Now, if you look at this formula, so then what you see, okay, I kind of rewrote it here. So, okay, so this correlation depends on the sampling algorithm. So there is this part that would normally decrease as square root over n for random sampling. But if my sampling is not random, so then there is an additional factor square root of large n, and n, capital N is the size of your population. Okay, so therefore, if the sampling is not random, so I pick up this additional square root of large N here. And to get a convergent result for the expectation value, the correlation, it should not be just going like between minus one and one, but it should decrease like one over the square of capital N, so square root of full population. Okay, so basically your sampling algorithm should be more and more, how to say it, uniform, if you like. It's basically should reproduce the population in a very, 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 very uniform way. If you don't do that, so then this deviation will not go down, like by one over square root of lowercase n, okay? And so that's what is the problem with this voting service. And for example, there will be problems with the voting service for this election because of this problem. So you cannot guarantee that your confounding correlation goes down like one over the square root of capital N for the polls. Okay. Let me pause here and see if that's clear.
The capital N you're talking about here is the
size
overall
of the population.
All of the whole population of voters.
Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. Or it can be the full population of PDF solutions. Okay, so the bigger problems, the bigger this population is. Okay, so that's what leads to this big data paradox that we want to avoid if we don't pay attention to that, right? Because if we don't pay attention to it, so we can get a very wrong prediction with very high confidence if we have a big data sample. Okay,
so is this like the model space in some sense?
It's like parameter space, yeah. Okay. Okay, now, so then what's the way around it? So the way around it is that you ask, well, for my problem at hand, do I really care about 300 parameters? But maybe there are just a few parameters that control my variable. And in that case, I don't need to sample the whole parameter space. I just sample that manifold that is related to my observable. And so that's what I will discuss next. Now, I'll have to speed up a little bit, but I can, well, if you like, work through the details, but essentially what we would like to is investigate other PDF solutions or uncertainties exhaustively sampled, and other unstated prior constraints that mess up our sampling, okay? And so we will use this hopscotch technique, hopscotch scan technique, to understand what's going on. Now we will use the NNPDF public code for fitting. We will not fit anything, but we'll just test the chi-squared for the solutions. Okay, so we'll use it, basically we'll produce some, trial PDF sets. We calculate the chi-squared, we see if this PDF gives a good chi-squared, and then we ask what cross-section what cross-sections this PDF set predicts. So that's kind of the game. So basically we use the verified replicas from NNPDF, from the LHA PDF library. And so then we have a code that generates this additional replicas. And then we basically examine how the cross sections and chi-squared values distributed for these replicas. So that's kind of the gist of it. Now, why is it called the hopscotch scan? Well, the idea is it's actually Aurora or Aurore Courtois, one of the authors of this analysis. So she proposed it. Well, it's kind of like, if you think about it, I would like to explore this big space, big room here, right? So I need to, let's say it is such a huge room and I need to know, what, okay, so in which direction to go. So what I need to do is that I can select a direction, and I can even draw this hopscotch on this squares that you see here. And then now I just, well, I would like to, I know that, for example, there is a particular set of squares relevant for our cross sections. So I kind of hop on them and do more random Monte Carlo sampling just for that piece of the, well, my multidimensional space. And so that's the idea. So basically what we need to do is we need to figure out in which directions in the parameter space we should go. And then that's what we draw our court, our hopscotch court. And then we kind of randomly jump around and produce replicas to kind of, but the density will be large enough so we can obtain a very good convergence with a small number of replicas because we just focus in that direction. Okay. Again, let me pause here, see if any questions, comments.
So, but the analogy with this that you're making is that the choice of direction is in the smaller manifold?
It results in a smaller manifold, right? So basically I know the few parameters that in my PDFs that gives you the largest variation, let's say in the Higgs cross section, right? And I simply explore those parameters, okay? And so then now I have a few slides explaining how this is done. Maybe again, I can come back to it, but because we need to speed up a little bit. Now, there is an issue that actually, this is something that I want to discuss that comes up, which is the following. I mentioned to you that we look at, not only on the PDF, but we'll also look at the chi-squared. So basically we ask how likely the PDF is according to the analysis. And here's a problem that I want to point out. Basically, even any analysis that we use, either CT or an NPDF, actually they don't work just with one chi-squared value, but you can write chi-squared in a number of ways. It's just like you write a cost function when you draw the neural network replicas. You can get somewhat different preference depending on the value of the cost function that you use. So here I will discuss two kinds of prescriptions that either NNPDF or CT will use, which is related to how we publish, implement the correlated systematic errors from the experiment. Essentially, how many of you know what D'Agostini's bias is? D'Agostini's bias or additive versus multiplicative errors. No, okay. So basically, well, roughly speaking, take the CMS data. The CMS data will provide us typically with a correlation matrix for n lambda nuisance parameters, but they provide us not as in absolute values, but as relative values multiplied by some quantity, which is called xi. So basically we have a matrix sigma ir alpha, which is given by NPDF, but we don't know what xi is. And we have to decide what is this xi. So it's basically xi can be the central data value, unfluctuated data value, or it can be the central theory value, or it can be something else. And so when we convert.
You mean like just the difference between a covariance and correlation matrix?
Well, covariance is here. So correlation, this is for the correlation matrix. But then there is a covariance matrix here, right? So covariance and correlation are related by this closed formula. But this beta is okay. So even if you assume that these nuisance parameters are 100% correlated, they are still not given in the full form for us. They are given as relative values normalized to something. And so this something can be experimental value. And so that will correspond to the experimental scheme or the theory value. It's called the T0 in this case. So then you can have two values of chi-squared. And so then NNPDF uses both of them. But also they calculate, actually they minimize the chi-squared with respect to fluctuated data. Okay, so use the chi-squared and the T0 definition, and they fix the fluctuated data, and they include some prior constraints in addition that tells us basically, for example, implement some kind of smoothness or integrability conditions that I mentioned to you, right? Now you also use this EXP scheme. When they quote the final result, they show the chi-squared and the EXP scheme in their paper. Now, why they do that? Well, the main reason is that they get a lower chi-squared when they use the XP scheme than compared to the T0 scheme, I think. So maybe there is another reason, okay, so that's one explanation. So the chi-squared for the XP can be 340 units lower than for the T0 scheme now. But they say we don't use the XP scheme in our fit because it may introduce the bias. And so now, in our opinion, it's not entirely clear which one. But actually, both of them can be biased because both of these T0 or XP scenarios can be biased because they are missing some part of information about systematic errors. So then we can use this hopscotch scheme to understand the regions of, well, basically generate the replicas by targeting, by populating directions relevant for Higgs, for example, for Higgs versus Z cross sections. And we can ask, well, do we find the replicas from the NNPDF analysis that have as good chi-squared as the nominal NNPDF or better, and that lie outside of the nominal uncertainty bands? Okay, and so then again, if you, well, if you have time, I can explain what we did. But we find a couple of things. So let's look at this plot. So, basically, the first thing that we notice, so here we plot CT18 and CT18 ZPDFs. And as I mentioned to you, the difference between them is simply the choice of the experiment, essentially one experiment plus the scale choice. And our uncertainty, as you see, is quite large, right? So in both cases, but the uncertainty is large enough so that these two solutions will almost overlap. So then the NNPDF, the nominal set, it gives you a very small uncertainty here, right? But we can use this technique of Scotch scale technique to ask, well, are there any regions according to other experimental or chi-squared definition, that have good chi-squared, but they lie outside of the nominal uncertainty band. And we find a couple of things. The first thing is that whether we use the chi-squared in the experimental or T0 definition, the likelihood is more or less Gaussian. And so what this tells you is that when you project this likely near a Gaussian likelihood on this plane, so you will get ellipses. So now the second thing that we find is that, for example, let's take the T0 definition. So let's measure the chi-squared with respect to the thread point here. So then, according to the nominal uncertainty band, so all your solutions with good chi-squared should sit somewhere here in the red band, in the red ellipse. But we find is that the region of replicas with chi-squared, delta chi-squared less than zero. So chi-squared is better than for the central replicas is given by the green ellipse. It's quite a bit larger. And then if you use the experimental definition that, as I mentioned to you, it's used not for fitting the replicas, but it is used to demonstrate the quality of the fit. So then we get this blue band, the blue ellipse that has delta chi-squared experimental less than zero. And within it, there is even a more compact region that has delta chi-squared that can be as low as minus 8. Okay. So then now you see there is a clear dependence on the, well, both on the sampling, but also on the chi-squared definition. Okay. So let me pause here and see if, yes.
So I understand the argument that you're making about the uncertainties are larger than they're represented in the red ellipse. Do you have anything to say about the fact that when you look at these expanded uncertainties, they actually are in kind of the opposite direction of the other PDF sets?
Well, this one goes kind of goes.
They're sort of, yes. Yeah.
I think what really happens is that there are these many factors that kind of conspire, right? And so the full uncertainty is probably will be something like this, right?
Okay.
Right. And so you cannot just say it's little one, it's much bigger. Okay.
But it doesn't overlap much more.
No, it doesn't. Yeah. And again, there are other choices made in this analysis, for example. So there are the data sets, right? Okay, now,
So are you saying that, like, when you use this technique, many of the solutions you find are outside of the nominal red band, or just that you can find some solution? Because in such a high dimensional space, it's not crazy to me that there's always going to be some solution that you can find
but
sufficiently high dimensional space.
Yeah, let me see. Actually, there are quite a few of them. So basically there is this, what we see is that we can look at the log likelihood. And the log likelihood, let's say with this experimental definition, will predict the minimum say somewhere here.
Mm-hmm.
And you see that dependence is quite regular in this case, in both cases, in all directions. If you take the nominal NNPDF sets, so they will tell you that they give you 100 replicas, right? So for this 100 dimensional space, they give you 100 replicas. So their sampling must be extremely efficient to do that. But more 68% out of these replicas will sit in this red ellipse. 34 will sit outside, right?
Yeah.
But the chi-squared, best chi-squared is here.
Okay.
Okay, so there is a displacement, okay? So then if you want to make conclusions about this specific observables, you want to try to see if there are such issues that exist with a provided set. Okay, so I think I'm almost out of time, but something very quickly that I want to point out is that these replicas that either green or blue ones, they are provided on our website, which is shown here. And if you would like to play with them a little bit yourself, you can just download them, that is ILHC PDF grids. And also, if you take any of these Hessian eigenvector sets, so there is, what I pointed out is that the in each direction, so the central replica zero, this red point, always sits at zero here in these units that I chose on the horizontal axis. The chi-square dependence is actually, it can be suggest a minimum that is displaced with respect to the central replica zero. And this also means that there is a second set that has delta exactly the same chi-square as replica zero. And that's what's shown by yellow triangle here. So we provide the grids for these points as well. And again, you can explore how your conclusions depend on using this, driving these additional sets compared to the NNPDF central set. So there is this whole discussion is why NNPDF does not find them. And again, I probably don't have time to go through this. I'll be glad to answer later. But for example, you can plot this alternative sets on the top of the regular NNPDF error bands. And you see that all of them are more or less consistent with the NPDF error band. So there is no obvious, at least to us, no obvious pathology that is happening with them. And the other thing is that generally speaking, if you include this yellow error bands, so you will get the larger uncertainties. So therefore, you get larger uncertainties. For example, there was a paper about the three sigma evidence for the so-called intrinsic charm based on the blue band that is shown here. So it was published a couple of months ago or so. But if you include this alternative sets, the three sigma evidence is washed away, okay? So therefore, clearly these alternative sets will affect your conclusions. Okay, and I think I'm out of time, but just the concluding remarks is that basically when you use the PDS, you have to be careful, right? And so that's the main message. For example, if you use a standard program like XFitter, and they use a tolerance that called delta chi squared equal one tolerance with a few parameters that you can use out of the box. But if you do that, so you will get an underestimated uncertainty because you do not account for this proper sampling of all possible solutions. So it's too restrictive. Now, on the other hand, if you have a large parameter space, so it's very hard to sample it. And so that's what you see the analysis NPDF, it's a great analysis. So they had all sort of technical developments to produce this fits. But because it's so complex, so you have to be, again, careful with sampling solutions that come out of it. That's why you also want to use the PDFs like CT18 or MSHT that use analytic minimization rather than the Monte Carlo sampling, because that may find solutions that the Monte Carlo sampling may miss. And then this hopscotch technique can be used to test your PDF uncertainties for a specific observable. And so it works by selecting the few dimensions that are relevant for your analysis. Now, finally, something that I want to point out is that for PDF fits, we really need better models for systematic errors, and they must be more complete so that we don't have to guess how to normalize this relative uncertainty. Okay, and so I think it's kind of a big outstanding question, but really, if we want to have improved uncertainty, let's say at 1% accuracy in 10 years, we have to do N2LO and N3LO calculations, of course. Right, we have to have Parton showers, PDFs, fast interfaces that must be comparably accurate. But then something that I pointed out, so to have representative uncertainty estimates, we have to be serious about systematic errors and how we present them and how we estimate them. So there is a nice paper that was proposed suggesting what can be done in that direction. And so finally, there must be some kind of, to really reach this accuracy, there must be some perhaps also even cultural change in our community, because all these issues need to be considered systematically and sort of to achieve system-wide process accuracy control at multiple stages. Okay. And so thank you so much for your attention.
Okay, so I think we can ask more questions with both outside or inside. Yeah.
That's right.
Anyone from Zoom? So I wonder how if we experiment on this, make our data, like experimental uncertainty, much smaller, does it help?
Well, you mean statistical uncertainty or
approaches like systematic?
Yes, it helps. And again, the point is that, well, obviously we are working towards having smaller uncertainties, right? But again, I think that part of the issue is that, well, there are two issues, right? So you want to reduce them as much as possible. You also want to be as complete as possible, right? And so therefore, like, for example, one of the issues for the PDA fits is that some uncertainties are estimated by comparing two showering programs, let's say Sherpa versus PCR. And then you have a 2-point uncertainty, but you are simply to be Gaussian, and that's dangerous. So you want to spend more time, you need to invest more into understanding these types of uncertainties. But also when you provide the final information to PDA fits, you don't want us to reverse engineer exactly what happened within the estimation of the uncertainties, because that doesn't help us. That introduces the additional source of ambiguity that I described. And that's again, that's why we probably need to talk about it as a community. Yes.
So it seems to me that like the Monte Carlo techniques for the neural network approaches, like you're saying that the advantage of the analytic approach is that you don't have to do as much sampling. But isn't like 50% of the analytic approach like coming, the uncertainty coming from the functional form? And you can't really do that analytically, right? I'm assuming you try as many as possible. It's in some way you're doing a sampling of the functional space, which
yeah,
is not analytic.
Yeah, but okay, no. And again, so these two, that's why I say these approaches are complementary.
Yeah.
But the point is the following, that for a typical LHC applications, you actually don't need the neural network to parameterize typical shapes, because
sure.
At most you need maybe 4 or 5 parameters per flavor. And that already gives you enough flexibility, and it's not too flexible. So therefore, now these issues about sampling that I described, they are certainly relevant for our analysis. And that's the idea. I can skip these slides. But basically, if we just take, well, okay, so what is shown here, when we provide the PDF set, before we do that, we do fits with about 300 alternative parameterization forms.
Mm-hmm.
And then we get this, here we show strangeness, get the green predictions that kind of will be around. So then finally we provide one error set based on one functional form. But we select the uncertainty so that we cover solutions with this alternative forms.
Right.
And that's what we do. And then we get the larger uncertainty,
mm-hmm.
right? So like, for example, what is shown here, we could use an uncertainty, the prescription, uncertainty prescription used by MSHT. So then we'll get a smaller uncertainty, the green band, as compared to our blue one.
Right.
Now, then some people say, okay, MSHT is more precise than CT. We are not going to use CT. And I say, that's you shouldn't do that because the precision of the, or let's say, completeness of the analysis is comparable in CT and MSHT. Okay, so therefore, do not just go for a nominally precise PDF. So all three groups are doing their earnest effort to get a good uncertainty estimates. And the fact that we get the larger one does not mean that we're less accurate.
Yeah, I wasn't trying to say that you're not accounting for that uncertainty. It's just that the same idea that you're sampling, you have to write down 300 functional forms, right? And that's clearly a choice you're making. That's a biased sampling of all possible function space that could describe the data you have.
Yeah.
And so I wonder, could you do hopscotch on that sort of thing and see
absolutely.
How well?
Yes, absolutely. And that's again, the main message is that all groups should do that.
Yeah.
Experimentalists should know that. And that's why probably if we understand that, so then hopefully we'll be doing all this analysis in a more complete way to, avoid potential pitfalls. Yeah.
Somewhat reminds me of discrete profiling and say like hasty gamma gamma fits where they posit a set of function classes, and then within each function class, they do the usual analytic minimization, and then they take the envelope of the minimum likelihood as the final uncertainty band. So it sounds kind of like you're saying, we need to find a middle ground between like replicas and
a local expansion in one parameterization, mm-hmm. and by just providing several parameterizations and maybe a local expansion in each, perhaps.
Yeah.
But I mean, even in a single parameterization, a local expansion, I would think is still somewhat risky because there's a possibility of other local minima, right? And the Hessian expansion tells you nothing about the other local minima.
Yeah, well, but then again, what happens normally in this analysis is that we try to look for this, exclude this possibility that we are stuck in the local minimum, right? And the minimum itself already has some of the features to kind of avoid it. But you could try various things. You could try to start from a different point. You could use, I think there are these minimizers that now kind of do more random jumps to basically avoid local minima.
Yeah, but I mean, if you are in a global minima, there may be another slightly less deep one very close by, as say like a bimodal distribution, for example.
Yeah.
Right? So that, again, Hessian.
Well, then now in the right examples like this, not in this for this unpolarized PDFs, but for example, for the polarized PDFs, you can have two minima, and then you have to provide solutions in both minima. And so that's again, well, basically, you have to pay attention, as you say, so that to this kind of issues is not
there. But in the regular PDFS, you're saying it's mostly convex.
Yeah, what you see is basically you see mostly convex. You see the same profile for proton PDFs. It's more like this string landscape issue, except it's a landscape here in Chicago, right? So you have, you know, very 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 mild landscapes.
The hills of Chicago.
But it's fundamentally, it's a related issue like the string landscape. Like, our likelihood is much milder, much better behaving function than the string landscape. So it's.
Yeah. You know, Chicago's on a continental divide,
yeah.
A subcontinental divide. All the water on one side of this particular street in Chicago flows to the St. Lawrence Seaway, and all the water on the other side flows to the Gulf of Mexico.
Yeah.
You wouldn't know where that is.
Right.
And they actually dug a channel through it to redirect the Chicago River.
Right. Yeah, okay. So maybe we should dug a channel in the PDF parameters.
Yeah, exactly. get to the different minimum.
Okay. Yes.
So maybe I just want to ask another one regarding analysis for the hopscotch scale.
Uh-huh.
So maybe I'm oversimplifying things. So maybe you are saying there's a bunch of data and you fit it, you get NNPDF. Mm-hmm. And then you use NNPDF to predict those bunch of data and you don't get the same result. So you're saying that like the best fit, like lowest chi-square is outside.
No. This data I was showing to you, it's not predicted. It's not fitted, it's predicted. So here basically we have a prediction for these cross sections at 13 TV. Based on the data that we fitted from 7 TV, 8 TV, and the other experiments.
Okay.
Right. Yeah, but yes, of course, what we also do is that we ask, this is an important question, is that you may say, why an NPDF does not find these replicas? Well, one answer is that maybe these replicas do not pass their quality criteria like smoothness, overfitting, even though it seems to do, we pass it okay based on this criteria in the CETA group. But the other thing can be is that, let's say, we fit because of the bias, we fit one experiment too well and the other experiment poorly, and we still get a better chi squared. And so, that kind of again, you need to test for those kinds of issues as well. And now, if you are interested how to do that, so basically, 2 years ago or 3 years ago, Dave Sopa, Karl Kavarik, and myself wrote a review in particle review of modern physics discussing all these various tests. And so sometimes it's probably easier to take the PDF and apply by check if they pass all these tests than to find out how exactly these PDFs are obtained. And so that's, well, basically, you can, for example, if you're not sure if you trust the PDF, you can try to understand how exactly it behaves and see if you see any pathologies.
I guess in some sense, this plot is just showing the failure of propagating a Hessian of the PDF to the evaluation of a given cross-section.
Well,
or?
No, what it really shows is that again, there is a minimum. Actually, what you see is that basically, You already see it in this scans of chi-squared along the 50 directions, right, along that we were insert a coordinate system in this parameter space.
Yeah.
And all of them show, well, quasi Gaussian dependence, but the minima of most of these parabolas are displaced. And so what this tells you is that the NNPD of mass at the central replica zero, actually, it does not find
it's
the
not
global the, minimum yeah. according to well, this more targeted Keshe eigenvector scan.
Why would they not publish the global minimum?
Well, they didn't know that they did not find it. So that's now.
It has to be their external constraints, because if you're able to find it without, like, if they were, they probably that's changing their likelihood somehow if they're externals
right.
with this context layer or something.
No.
But are you saying that if the 100 replicas were different 100 replicas, somehow, let's say that you do 100 and then you do another 100 and you do another 100 and another 100, that would also scan this and get in another place that is not into that circle?
Yeah, what happens is basically now, suppose we start adding. Well, basically, again, NNPDF has a certain training algorithm. And so what we do is that you fluctuate the data, you fit this data using the same training algorithm. And so then you plot predictions for these cross sections for each of these fits. So what will happen then is that for their training algorithm, so indeed, you can change, well, you generate 1,000 replicas, not 100 replicas. But 68% of these replicas will still sit within their 68% nominal 68% error ellipses. So then you ask, well, why did you don't find the replicas that have better chi squared that sit somewhere here? And the answer is because the training algorithm is restrictive. So it doesn't allow you to find the chi squared, well, basically, it doesn't allow you to include these replicas with high probability. So it will essentially reject it. So, but then we look at that replica and we see we don't see a problem. So that basically tells you there's something going on in their analysis that, well, they reject these replicas, but it's not obviously true that they have been bad solutions.
If nobody has, and I had a question about the inputs itself, that is there like any, like you show like a list of stuff from us of the wanted stuff, the precision, but is there a list of things that you guys would like as inputs that are not
so we'd like
easily obtainable or not, you know,
we have a list somewhere. Something that I want to mention is that there is a list in this the PDF the white paper on PDFs that was submitted to SNOMASS. So I think I showed it a little bit earlier. This is a white paper that we prepared using a large group of authors, and it addresses many questions about PDFs. But where is it? Oh, okay, here it is. Right. So that's the reference. There is a list of measurements that are sensitive to PDF or that we want to have to constrain the PDFs, and something like W plus charm is an interesting example, right? So, or Z plus charm, but with high accuracy. Again, there you need to really control systematic uncertainties. Jet production, LHCb, W and Z production in the forward regions are very interesting. Anything that is sensitive to the flavor separation. So like, for example, we saw that the strangeness has a large uncertainty compared to U bar and T bar. But even U bar and T bar are not constrained well at large X or at small X. In those measurements that probe them, so will be very useful. There are tools again to understand what is the main PDF combination that is constrained by the specific experiments. You can actually figure it out before you do the measurement. And so then those are discussed in this white paper.
And so there's like plans that people are doing these analysis that they will extract.
Yeah, but of course, well, again, what I've been told is that only very few people work on this, and that's the issue. Therefore, now what you hear from me is that really to do the analysis correctly, you actually need to not just to set up the analysis, you need to study these systematics very tediously, and that's not very glorious, right? So and therefore, well, unless we have some, you know, artificial intelligence that does it for us instead of the PhD students, so we don't have a good support for that. But these are very important again. So this is a very important, and hopefully I convince you it's also very interesting. Conceptually, can be very interesting work that tells you lots about this large data statistics. Yeah, okay, well, thank you for your attention.
Thank you.
So if you want to talk about it, I'm in the theory division on the third floor, and yeah, so.
Until when?
I'm until Thanksgiving, and then I'll come back, right? But for example, I really would like to understand if we can make a progress on better format for the systematic errors, and that.
Yeah, I'd like to understand that a little bit, because you, on your side where you're basically saying, I mean, I would have thought we provide the covariance and not the correlation. And then,
yeah,
but even if you have the correlation, as long as you have the square root of the diagonal of the covariance, you can work back. Right?
That's true. No, and actually, well, at least within CT, we like correlation better than covariance. But even with correlation, there is an issue that you publish relative uncertainties. And that introduces these differences that you saw between the ellipses.
Like
relative
parameters or parameters.
Yeah, so the correlation of or covariance, right? So basically, it will be equal to some, well, the matrix multiplying some central values, and so we need to decide central values of data or a specific theory, and that makes this, well, basically produces the differences that you see.
Because usually it would be unfolded bin cross-section values, right, that you would get the nominal and then the covariance, which is essentially the Hessian around R likelihood set.
Yeah. But again, you make an assumption it's Hessian or Gaussian. You make certain assumptions about degree of correlations. Right. The other issue that was pointed out is some of these covariance matrices, they are not mathematically stable.
Oh yeah, they're not. They have a high condition number.
Right.
Yeah.
So in that, they're like, for example, I would like to understand better, but presumably experimentalists should check that right before we start using it.
Well, I do, but.
but there are matrices. Okay, so basically, what to do with those matrices? Do you include them when they are already published?
Yeah. Right. Do you think that might actually be the source of some of these cross-experiment discrepancies? Is the local Hessian expansion is just not good enough to describe the likelihood?
I think it's entirely possible, right? And again, there are quite a few of these entries in this matrix that probably are not Gaussian. So then if you have some kind of module that just doesn't allow, well, basically you don't have to assume they're Gaussian. There is some kind of like, well, more general likelihood than you use it.
Publish the full likelihood, for example,
right.
The one with the actual observables bin,
right.
And the
right.
Nuisance parameters there. Yeah.
Right. And then maybe we can come up with some technique to, well, speed it up so that it's, because otherwise it will be slow. And, right. But the other thing is that, well, there are all these hundreds of nuisance parameters. You don't need to publish all of them because most of them will be just actually in the fields, they do not deviate from zero too much. So maybe you just need to observe them in some kind of uncorrelated errors, just keep the few most relevant combinations. Again, I, as a theorist, I do not want to do it. Because, you know, I'm kind of flying blindly about it. And so.
What kind of correlation model do you put in between experiments, if any?
That's a very good question. So then Atlas started doing fits to several channels, several processes using the appropriate correlation between these channels.
You're like full likelihood.
Yeah, right. And that's why this Atlas PDF 21, that's what they do. It's kind of a very neat technique.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so, well, there is some impact of that, but eventually, we also want to correlate between the various processes. Okay, well, thank you. So,
okay, thank you so much.